Hi, folks. This is Eric Davis, and you're listening to lecture number six for the Maybe Logic Academy course, Gnosis Now. And this lecture is entitled Poesis, which is a fancy Greek word for poetry, which really means making or creating. And I start off with a reading from Harold Bloom. And Harold Bloom is a character I first encountered when I studied literature at Yale, where he was one of the great literary professors there. And though I never took his courses directly, I saw him give a lot of lectures, and a lot of the professors I did take were very influenced by him. And even though by that point in my life I had already been interested in the occult and mysticism and spirituality for a number of years, this was the context where I first discovered Gnosticism, not in a study of religion per se, but in Harold Bloom's rather unique reading of Gnosticism. And that's what really interests me in this course, or in this particular talk, is how Bloom, along with two of the other authors, we'll read June Singer and a fellow named Eric Wilson, attempt to sort of use Gnosticism and reread it in an essentially secular guise. If 2 weeks ago we saw some modern philosophers find echoes of existentialism and other modern issues in Gnosticism, and last week we saw how some literary authors, sometimes coming from their own perspectives that had nothing to do with the ancient Near East, stumbled upon very similar archetypes and symbols and strategies that resonate with Gnostic approaches, and indeed, in some sense, permeate modern literature and certainly its more rebellious tendencies. And this week, we're looking a little bit more at more official languages of modernity, particularly the language of poetry, the language of reading, the language of psychology. In particular, with the other two texts, and showing how they too attempt to sort of rewrite or assimilate aspects of Gnosticism in order to make this old way of looking at the world alive again, and inevitably distorting it a little bit along the way. But that distortion, at least for Harold Bloom, is always part of the picture. One important idea of his that will help you go through this, what I think is really a marvelous little essay that begins his book, Aegon, which is one of the first places I read about Gnosticism, is his idea of the anxiety of influence. Basically, Bloom's vision of poetry in particular is an almost Freudian battle between sons and fathers, because, of course, most of them are male, although he applies the anxiety to female writers as well. The idea is basically that there are strong poets and weak poets, and that what happens when a strong poet of a younger generation comes into their own voice, they must struggle with the anxiety of being overly influenced by the strong poets of a previous generation. And in order to come into their own strength, to their own originality, they must not only struggle, but actually misread or misinterpret the strong poetic voices of the previous generation. The example that Richard Smalley points out in his book about Gnosticism, when he talks about Harold Bloom briefly, is William Blake's famous line that Milton was of the devil's party without knowing it. Because, of course, Milton himself, the great religious poet who wrote Paradise Lost, would never have considered himself part of the devil's party. And yet, William Blake, coming later, struggling with his own anxiety of influence, one of his poems is called Milton, wants to sort of recast or reread, or in Bloom's terms, misread his poetic forebear, and so s assimilates him to the position of rebellion, one that Milton himself would certainly not have taken. So what Bloom does then is to apply this this idea of a creative struggle to find an originality in relationship with previous powers as a model of spirituality, or at least visionary literature, as well as poetic literature. One of the great things about this essay is it does a very nice, quick job of summarizing some of the interesting, deep history of Platonism, because, of course, we've noticed already that in many ways ancient Gnosticism is a kind of mutation of Platonism, of the philosophy of Plato, or rather a Platonic reading of biblical materials. And one of the core ideas in this Platonic tradition is, of course, that there is a kind of spark or a kind of higher soul that is not of the world of matter, that it has something to do with reason, and that through reason we can perceive the ideal world of forms, which we only see reflected in the dirty entropic mud of material reality. And what Bloom reminds us is that behind this idea, this Platonic idea, is an older tradition of the detachable occult self, the self that is not identified with what he calls the psyche, or the more ordinary personality or more worldly aspect of the self. And this occult self, this detachable spark that he'll call pneuma, he traces back, and this is a kind of standard scholarly consensus at this point, traces it back to the shamans of the Scythian shamans, who, you know, had that would fill up tents full of cannabis, and, you know, had a more what we would recognize as a traditional kind of shamanic culture, with the shamanic idea that the shaman is able to detach their soul from their body and move through these other worlds and return. And what Bloom says is that what Plato does is kind of meld this, or misread in this anxiety of influence way, misread this idea by assimilating it into his more rationalist idea of reason as a higher faculty that's able to perceive the world of forms. Once he lays this out, then Bloom goes on and talks about poetry as a model of Gnosticism, and particularly Gnostic experience. And by poetry, he doesn't mean just that you can point to poems that use symbols and allegories that have a Gnostic character. That's not really very interesting to Bloom, and in some sense is not ultimately very interesting to us. It's just simply more, oh yeah, look, they're using, you know, Gnostic images. Okay, there's a pearl, there's a serpent. All right, great. What Bloom is trying to point to more is that that poetry allows a kind of knowing or a kind of experience in the reader, not in the poet himself, but in the reader, that has analogies with aspects of Gnostic experience. And one of the most important things for Bloom in talking about Gnostic experience is the idea that there is something original in us that is before creation, that is before nature. So he hones in on that particular aspect of Gnosticism, the idea that there are sparks of the Pleroma distributed through this lower creation of matter, and that these sparks, in some sense, are more original than all of the matter and the nature that they're embedded in. They're earlier. They're aboriginal. And that what this then gets manifested in the self, in our own personal psychology, mirrored in poetry, mirrored in philosophy, mirrored in what Bloom calls the American religion, which I'll get to a little bit more in a moment. But what's important for Bloom is this sense that there is something in us that is before nature. There is something in us that is before the world of matter and extension and diversity. In Zen terms, you could say this is what your face looked like before you were born, which is one of those Zen koans. So what is your face before you were born? It's some pure, unmediated, you know, what's it that is able to perceive, or continues to perceive as part of perception, even as it is constantly drawn into identification with matter, or identification with nature, or identification with the body, or with the ordinary personality, with what he calls the psyche. So there's this tension between the pneuma and the psyche, but it has to do in part with originality and with beforeness. Now, Bloom, in a fairly perverse way, or a strongly misreading way, identifies this spirit with what he calls the American religion. And what he wants to argue is that there is a kind of particular American sensibility that you find both in writers like Whitman and Emerson, and later writers like Wallace Stevens, that stress this kind of original self, this experience of the freedom of an original self. And then he links that with more conventional or mainstream experiences of religion in America, particularly forms of Protestantism, but also Mormonism and other things. Now, Bloom's book on the American religion, called The American Religion, is a great book. It's totally worth reading. It's really fun. He reads religious thinkers as if they were poets, without reducing them merely to literary language, because his own approach to literature is so spiritual. So it really gets to a very beautiful place, and it's full of fascinating ideas, but it's certainly unconventional. And indeed, when Richard Smalley addresses Bloom in Smalley's book on Gnosticism, Forbidden Faith, he pretty much takes him to task for kind of making it up, and saying, look, really, what does this have to do with the ancient Gnostics at this point? Aren't you just like broadening this term so far that it doesn't mean anything anymore? And we've already encountered that issue, that Gnosticism becomes a term of art in the critic, in the writer, in the philosopher, and it's sort of so loosely defined and so kind of, you know, mysterious and interesting and rebellious, that it's attractive to use it in a wide variety of ways, so much so that the use of the term itself arguably begins to wane. But I still think it's an extremely useful tack, and we see in the Bloom text a really beautiful approach to it. Another interesting thing to note is how he wants to shift while maintaining the validity of Gnostic experience and the Gnostic view of the world, shifted away from the religious sphere. And he does that by saying that the ultimate content of the Gnostic flash, of the experience of Gnosis, is not a Gnosticism, is not a religion or even a worldview or even information about the structure of the cosmos. It's ultimately knowledge of the self. And that this psychological dimension is what allows a continuity between a religious and a secular experience of Gnosis. And so he wants to say that the experience of Gnosis is still valid, and indeed is perhaps more valid in these rarefied worlds of literature, and particularly a certain strand of lyrical poetry that comes out of Romanticism. And finally, the aspect that I perhaps appreciate the most upon rereading this, which I had forgotten, is how he emphasizes that Gnosticism as a form of knowledge is not a content, is not static, and it is not about being. Usually when we think in terms of, like, you know, what's the essence of something, we think about it as having a being. And Platonism would itself support this, that if you get right down there, the ultimate being of something is its essence. And what Bloom is picking up in a somewhat existentialist way, although he's by no means an existentialist, is that what the content of Gnostic knowledge is not a being, but a happening, an event, a practice, something that moves. And he says, Gnosis, whether in Gnosticism or in Emerson, emphasizes that transition is more real than being. The psyche, that means the lower personality, belongs to experience, to time and history, to ordinary experience, what he means, to time and history, to what is moment to moment. But the knowing of Gnosis is momentary and beyond experience. It's performative knowledge. Now, exactly what that means is hard to say. obviously, what's the difference between experience and momentary experience? But he wants to emphasize that there is a rupture in gnosis, a rupture that is simultaneously an escape from the conventional order of beings, which is organized by society, which is organized by tradition, which is organized by history, by the body, by organs. If you remember Artaud going off about the body without organs. Instead, Bloom wants to point to a kind of rupture or a transition, a liminal zone, maybe even a kind of maybe logic that breaks the order of being in a way that escapes a certain kind of modern experience, even as it reproduces it. Because if modernity is about anything, it's about rupture. It's about breaking. It's about the struggle with the father. It's about overturning tradition. So in a weird way, Bloom is both being utterly modern and extremely traditional at the same time. And it's partly that balance in his work that I find so fascinating. You'll see in the poem that's attached to the PDF, that A.R. Amen's poem for Harold Bloom, I think a very beautiful poetic expression of this literary gnosis, and one that will resonate with a number of the images that we've already spoken about in this class, particularly the idea, the association of the pneuma or the spirit with the mountain, as opposed to the valley of the soul or psyche. But I'll leave you to read that poem, and just, you know, perhaps we can talk about it online, and I might come back to a Stevens poem at the end of this lecture too. But if you're at all intrigued by the Stevens quotes in the Bloom essay, I highly encourage you to read Stevens. He's definitely one of my favorite poets, and while he did love the body and love the world, and he was not a religious man in any sense, there is a profound Gnostic spirituality and even a kind of Buddhism in a lot of his writing that's made even more powerful by the fact that he's not trying to be spiritual. Now, the next text we read is in some ways a less interesting thing. It's by June Singer, who's a Jungian analyst and is very much working inside of Jung's frame of mind. And I chose it for a number of reasons. One is that it was very important to have some Jungian takes on gnosis included in the class because, again, as Richard Smoley notes, that Jung is probably the single most important force in bringing Gnosticism and Gnosis back into modern knowledge, beyond the esoteric world of theosophists and other sort of 19th century dabblers and mystagogues who became interested with the Gnostic texts that we had. Jung really took Gnosticism very seriously. He took it as a model of the psyche and not as a model of the cosmos, to the degree that he could maintain that particular paradox, but to the degree that he still approached things quote-unquote scientifically, or at least in terms of a secular framework of psychology, he brought Gnosticism out of a religious framework and into a modern psychological framework within which the idea of wholeness or of integration is a kind of goal, and that the Gnostic return to the pleroma, to the fullness, and their escape from the disaster of matter and the archons is actually a psycho-spiritual process of integrating the shadow side and the dark side of the psyche into a greater fullness. I'm not entirely convinced of this model, although I think it's very interesting to wrestle with, and I do believe that it explains part of the attraction to Gnosticism. I do think there's some violence done to the real alienation that's implied in Gnosticism, and particularly its hostility to the world and to many degrees matter. Nonetheless, it's an extremely rich and engaging way of looking at how people are attempting to misread, in Harold Bloom's terms, misread a tradition of Gnosticism into something that is useful and profound and resonant for modern human beings. So what Singer does, and it's a very elegant job of digging in and looking at one particular Gnostic text, something that comes from the Nag Hammadi books called, what is this called? Exegesis on the Soul. And chooses this text as a one that illustrates this process of individuation, of turning away from projection into the world towards a look at the self as a way of moving through and processing the shadow side and opening up to a higher principle that's a principle of integration that in turn kind of propels the self into a greater embrace of cosmic wholeness. So all that's very interesting. But the other reason that I chose this text is that it's a woman writing about a very feminine-oriented Gnostic text. And we have already mentioned the way that gender is a very rich and dynamic dimension of Gnostic experience and Gnostic writings. Not necessarily the feminist liberation that some people might want to believe with the sort of current wave of, you know, Magdalene, Gnostic, feminist, Da Vinci Code, blah, blah, blah. Nonetheless, the vision of gender and of feminine spirituality and feminine power is vastly richer and more dynamic in the Gnostic tradition than it is in the conventional Orthodox one. And so it's not accidental that Singer chose a text that is particularly highlighted in this way and sees the soul as essentially a feminine force, whose involvement in the world of the archons or the world of matter is seen in terms of prostitution and rape, and whose a recovery of the higher good is seen in terms of a preparation for a wedding and an ultimate encounter with a bridegroom, which with an explicit sexual dimension, although the text also emphasized that this is not a carnal encounter. Nonetheless, the images of union and of the bridal chamber, etc., are certainly using, like alchemy, the images of sexuality as a way to stage some deeper questions or experiences of wholeness and integration. I guess one of the other issues that this brings up for me is just the kind of over reliance on the image of wholeness as a good, as well as the, to my mind, fairly romantic idea that when we're floating in our mother's bellies, we're just in a blissful state of union, and only upon entering the world and getting our butt slapped do we break away from this kind of, you know, glorious fusion. And while there is clearly a drive towards fusion inside the human psyche, and that it's partly mediated through our relationship with our parents and with our mother and with lovers who then stand in for this sort of lost world, it's not clear to me that the lost world actually really exists or certainly existed in the womb, that, you know, even babies get knocked around and have a rough time inside the belly. So there's a little bit of a patina of a kind of holist romanticism that I don't find as resonant in Singer as I do in other texts. Nonetheless, I think it's a very valuable and nourishing way of looking at Gnostic imagery. The final text is a very short one by a fellow named Eric Wilson, about whom I know nothing, except that somebody pointed me to this really, really nifty essay that's clearly part of a larger work. And basically, Wilson is what we would call in modern terms a depressive, though we would call in more traditional terms a melancholic. And he's someone who's interested in valorizing or affirming depression as a rich state of being, or melancholia as a rich state of being with a lot of good to it. And this is, of course, going very much against the modern grain. And he wants to see it as a sort of veil of soul-making. And he's not the first to do this. The kind of post-Jungian psychologist James Hillman writes very, very eloquently and quite beautifully on melancholia and depression in terms of it being a site of meaning rather than something that needs to be avoided, or certainly something that needs to be medicated. And there's an interesting echo between Bloom and Wilson here when he talks about this issue of medication, because, of course, that's the great conflict right there. If one is going to approach one's depression as a possible site of meaning, one is confronting directly the dominant story and the dominant shamans in our society, which are the doctors holding pills, letting you know that depression is simply an organic malady that you're not responsible for, has nothing to do with you as a person, and can be treated through a combination of pills and therapy, blah, 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 blah. You know the story. So to instead say, well, actually, in some ways, I am my melancholy, or I want to affirm my melancholy and actually explore it, is really kind of a nutso move. And at one point, Wilson says, I am not reducible to neurons and my surroundings. So he's explicitly saying that there is a part of the self, a part of his self, that is not reducible to the materialist account of subjectivity. He says that something in my being transcends these limiting factors. Certainly I cannot escape entirely my faulty neurotransmitters or my vexed history. However, I can choose how I interpret these boundaries. I can see them as important but not final factors in my melancholia, and I can see this choice as an enactment of my freedom. I think this is a beautiful, not only psychological insight, but a beautiful reflection of a genuine Gnostic wrestling that, to my mind, is more believable and useful than the one we saw with Singer, because, of course, Wilson does go on later to valorize the Gnostics as people who really recognize the same power of dark perception that he talks about. But in this idea that he's laying out, we see an echo of Bloom, that there isn't something in the self that is not reducible to the order of facts that constitutes nature, even the order of facts that proves that obviously our psychological states are directly influenced by the state of our brain, by balances of neurotransmitters, etc., etc. No one can deny that. Wilson is not attempting to deny it. But what he is saying is that there's something in the self that eludes this network, and that in choosing that perception, or in choosing to inhabit that fragment or that spark, that very choice is an enactment of freedom, even as that freedom or that enactment of freedom takes place within a network of fate, within a network of necessity, the necessity of having a brain, the necessity of having a crappy history or a crappy relationship with your parents, or most importantly here, the necessity of confronting the neurological facts that constitute you. So this dance of freedom and fate is, to me, one of the most important dynamics that we draw out of Gnosticism, that there's, on the one hand, a very intense and sobering view of the nature of control, the nature of necessity embedded in our bodies, in societies, in nature, in the processes of organic decay. And yet there is a line of freedom, but it's a very elusive one, and it's difficult to pinpoint. At the end of Harold Bloom's essay, he talks about that that freedom in Wallace Stevens is always a matter of evasion. It's not taking a position or arguing some philosophical point that clears a space for the being of freedom. Instead, freedom is found through a kind of evasion, and that the spiritual aspect of Stevens' poetics is often through this kind of elusive, slippery, almost like a wink-wink out of the corner of your eye. And the sense there is that maybe that's it. Maybe that is the place of transition. That is the place of the slippage that allows us or opens up a space of genuine freedom, not something that we can ever really pin down or ever really carve out of this sort of maelstrom of forces and networks that are constantly trying to vex us. As an example of this evasion, and I'm not saying you're going to pick it up the first time you hear it, but I would just like to read one of my favorite Stevens poems and one of his most famous poems, and it was it's said to have been the last poem he wrote, so it's like a death poem in Japanese tradition, and it's called Of Mere Being. The palm at the end of the mind, beyond the last thought, rises in the bronze decor. A gold-feathered bird sings in the palm, without human meaning, without human feeling, a foreign song. You know then that it is not the reason that makes us happy or unhappy. The bird sings, its feathers shine. The palm stands at the edge of space. The wind moves slowly through the branches. The bird's fire-fangled feathers dangle down. See you online.
And that concludes this lecture.